This is Luxury.
And Diallo.
The hosts of One Song. And we'd like to thank the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
And now, join Kevin Hart as he dives into the minds of some of the world's funniest comedians. This is Comedy Gold Mines with Kevin Hart.
Welcome, world. Welcome to an all-new episode of Comedy Gold Mines, where we do what? You should know the answer to that question by now. We'll be getting to the minds of brilliant comedians. And oh my God, what amazing minds they are. Well, today will be no different. The creative mind that we have with us today, well, he keeps climbing to newer heights as a comedian every year. He's an actor, writer, producer, author. I mean, God, from 2019's Netflix special called The New One to his touring one-man shows. He's multi-faced. Is that right? Did I say that word? Is it multi-faced or faceted? It's faceted. Multifaceted? Multi-faced? I don't know, guys. Sometimes I struggle with words. It's all about me being human, okay? I'm going to say faceted. It's multifaceted. He has had a major role on TV and film, including 2015 Judd Apatow's Trainwreck, recurring roles on Orange is the New Black, and his role on Showtime hit Billions more recently. He's put out a podcast titled Working It Out. Make sure to go check that out, by the way. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mike Birbiglia. Mike, what's going on, champ?
What's up, Kev? Good to see you.
Mike, did I pronounce that word right?
Yeah, I think so. Multifaceted?
Faceted. God damn it. What did I say? I said face it, right? I said something stupid. I struggle with my vocabulary, Mike. I really do.
Kev, I was watching this video that Fallon posted the other day of the two of you on a roller coaster, and I don't know if I've laughed that hard in so long, because you're one of the few people.
It was real.
Who, when I see you struggling, I enjoy it. I like you, but I enjoy it. And then at the end of the roller coaster, he goes, "We're going again." And your fucking face. You're going to go again. Oh my God.
I couldn't get off. Son of a bitch had me strapped in. There's nothing I could do. We're strapped in.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where it's like, you know, it's late night TV. It's a talk show. They're like, "We got a great idea for a stunt." I'm like, "Mike, I don't really know, you know." I don't know about the whole roller coaster thing, guys. I don't fuck with roller coasters. Yeah. I was very honest with them. They was like, "Oh, Kev, but it'll be great. It's you and Jimmy. He doesn't really ride them either. Maybe you guys do it. Face your fear. What do you think?" I'm like, "All right." I'm like, "Yeah. All right. Okay. Let's do it." I'm thinking it's going to be quick, you know, like a little 15 second. That might have been one of the roller coasters I've ever been on in my fucking life, man. It was like a minute and some change for a roller coaster ride. It's forever. Forever. Are you a roller coaster guy? You an amusement park guy?
No, man. I was so glad to watch you and Jimmy on there because, yeah, I don't like roller coasters. I remember going to carnivals when I was a kid. Do you remember the Scrambler at carnivals?
Yes, I do.
Where it's like, you know, you're going around, around, around. And I remember I was on once with a girl. I talk about this in my special girlfriend's boyfriend, but my girlfriend's boyfriend where I had a crush on this girl, and we go on the Scrambler, and I'm thinking, like, maybe we're going to make out, or maybe this is going to go somewhere, and then I throw up on the Scrambler. And, of course, the thing is whipping around. So you're basically – you're throwing up like a lawn sprinkler.
Oh,
like,
no. Oh, no. Oh.
You know, like popcorn and cotton candy and peanuts. And it was I don't think I've gone on since. I don't think I've gone on since high school.
Well, by the way, you shouldn't. If that's a problem that you have, Mike, you shouldn't go on again. Mike, let's talk comedy, man.
Let me start by saying I love the show. I listen to it on Sirius.
Mm-hmm.
I listen to the pod. I love the episodes with Sarah Silverman, Bill Burr.
Thank you, man.
And I really respect what you're doing. I've been loving what you're doing for so many years now, so it's an honor to be on.
Oh, man, thank you. I'm glad to have you on. I'm a fan of comedy. So me being a fan of comedy, I love reaching out to just all of the comedians that I've encountered, you know, conversations and experiences with, that I know, that I've been in the trenches with. Mike, I've known you for quite some time, man. And knowing you, it's always been, you know, just in a comedian way, right? Like, I feel like there's a certain synergy that comedians have where we're always accepting, but for the most part, we should be accepting and welcoming to one another. Of course, with some, it's different. But for the most part, in our world, this is what it is. It's fraternity. But I've never really gotten to know you. I don't know a lot about you. So in this case, in this time now, I feel like I have an opportunity to do just that. Where did it start for you? How did comedy start?
Started in high school. So I grew up in Central Mass, Massachusetts. And my brother Joe's 5 years older than me. And he took me to see Stephen Wright live at the Cape Cod Melody Tent, which you've probably played Cape Cod Melody.
I have.
And, it was one of those things where I wonder if you ever had this in Philly with anyone where I just go, fuck, like that's it. What he's doing, that's what I got to do. Whatever it is he's doing, you know, just even seeing someone, you know, just a great joke teller like Stephen Wright is. I was just like, I got to do that. I went home. I wrote tons of jokes in a notebook. They're all garbage, of course. And then when I was in college, I went to Georgetown and I entered the funniest person on campus contest and I won. And then it was crazy. I'd never done stand-up and I won and I got the chance to open for someone at the DC Improv. And I looked at I went to their website and I looked and I saw it go, oh, Dave Chappelle's coming. I asked if I could open for Dave Chappelle. This is pre-Chappelle show. This is pre-everything. This is before Half-Baked, you know. And I opened for Chappelle. I opened for, you know, I got a job at the door.
How the fuck did it go this fast? Jesus Christ, Mike. I mean, you're talking about coming out the gate.
But that was like pre-Chappelle. Like, he was 24.
Okay.
He was like, we're talking like I was 19. He was 24.
Okay. Give me a timestamp. What year?
Timestamp is like 97.
Wow, I just graduated from high school.
Isn't that crazy?
Just graduated from high school.
Yeah, you and I are almost exactly the same age. So I graduated in 96.
Yeah.
And then, then I'm in DC and it's like, you know, I'm working the door and I'm watching like Chris Paul and, you know, Brian Regan and Paul Mooney, rest in peace. Paul Mooney would come through like once, twice a year. And I would work the door and I'd seat people, bring them quesadillas. And I would just watch the masters, you know, I was just like studied, just took it all in.
When do you feel like you started to understand, because you say like, you know, you're fresh out of high school, out of, you know, you're 19 years old right now. So at this point, you know, comedy isn't a thing that you've dissected.
Yeah.
Like you said, you had jokes, but they were all trash. When did it start to click for you? When did you start to figure out who you were on stage?
I think when I came to New York, moving to New York from anywhere. I mean, in this case, I was pretty good in DC. You go to New York, you're garbage.
Was comedy the reason for the move?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I moved to New York to pursue comedy. And then I was lucky because I had opened for Brian Regan and Dennis Regan, Brian Regan's brother. Dennis Regan had worked in New York for years. And so he was like, I opened for them right before I graduated. And Dennis goes, I'm going to call Esty at the Comedy Cellar. I'm going to call Lucian Hold at the Strip and Chris Mazzilli, Gotham. The one that took me was Lucian Hold. You remember Lucian?
I remember Lucian. Yeah.
Passed away years ago. And Lucian, you know, he sort of just gave me a lot of spots. And then the other thing was one of the best things, it's probably where we met actually in hindsight, is one of the best things I could have ever done is he gave me a slot hosting Sunday night. So I'd host and it'd be like 15, 16 comics. Show would start at like 7:30, go to like 1 a.m. So you sort of just meet everybody.
You start to build.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then like,
that's when you get the comedy shops.
Yeah. And then like, you know, eventually I got into the Cellar and then I just started, you know, the big thing was like colleges. Like I was, no one really wanted me to do an hour. I couldn't work at comedy clubs as a headliner. I mean, I had colleges. I don't know if you had this starting out where you'd show up and they'd just go, so we have you in this cafeteria and
oh my God.
You know what I mean? And then you go, okay.
Oh my God, the lunchroom. Yeah.
You had the lunchroom, man.
There's no stage. There's no like, literally on the college circuit, it got to a point where you kind of never knew what you were going to get at one point in your career.
Yeah.
You just know that you're going to perform, but then you get there and then it's a discovery. You're in the lounge. You're in the den. We call this the lion's den. Yeah, I'm sorry, what? The lion's den. You just come up here and we got the students all gathering around.
Yeah.
And you're like, holy shit. You're like, it showed you what the real layers to comedy actually were. And it kind of made you appreciate that road even more.
That's how I sort of figured out how to do an hour on stage. Because I think when you're starting out, you're doing 5 minutes, you're doing 10 minutes, and you're looking at these guys doing an hour. Like, how would I do that? I don't know how to do an hour of comedy. And then as you show up at a college, they go, I had colleges, Kev, where I would show up and they go, so we have you down for 2 hours. We're like, what? You're like, what do you mean?
Oh my God.
Like, I don't have 2 hours. Oh, I don't have 2 hours of material.
What did you do? Because
they're booking bands, they're booking whatever. You know, you do anything. You do crowd work. You bring people, you bring college students on stage, you interview them. I mean, it's crazy. But it's, you know, it's trial by fire and you get better. I mean, what's crazy is I look back and I go like, I was lucky. I was lucky to have all those gigs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because when you look back at it, I can truly say NACA, the experience in NACA. So for my listeners, NACA is a, how would we describe this, Mike? It's basically it's
College Booking Student Association.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Okay. And what you do as comedians, we would have to perform in NACA.
Yeah.
And there's, like you said, the Students Performing Association, right? They're there. And they're there from colleges all over. And they're watching the show.
Yeah.
And after the show, it was your job to have a booth set up or a station set up. And colleges would just stop by.
Like a convention.
Yeah, like a convention. Yeah. They would just stop by your booth, your station. And if you were good, they were like, we want to book you.
Yeah.
And then they would give you a date.
Yeah.
And the goal was to leave this thing with a crazy amount of dates.
Yeah.
You had to leave NACA with a crazy amount of dates. And when I tell you, that's what paid the bills for me.
Same.
For quite some time, man. It was the NACA, Mike.
Same.
NACA did it.
I remember when I was doing NACA's.
National Association for Campus Activities.
Daniel Tosh was doing some of the same NACA's as me. I would book like 15. He'd book 100.
Yes, he was a monster.
He'd book 100.
Daniel Tosh was a monster.
I go, how do you book 100 colleges in a day?
A monster on the college circuit.
Yeah. College kids loved Daniel Tosh.
Daniel Tosh, Dane Cook, the two biggest college acts I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, at that time, because that's, you know, you're talking about the beginning.
Early 2000s.
Yeah. And even in that time, like the comedians, you know, if you were getting a good NACA run, I mean, your hot comic getting 5,000 to 10,000 maybe?
Yeah, sure.
5-10, and you figure that comic had 100 dates?
Yeah.
Oh my God. That comic was the talk of the fucking town. The talk of the town.
Next thing you know, his brother's in prison. You know, anything can happen.
This is Luxury.
And Diallo.
The hosts of One Song. Shout out to U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for supporting this podcast and for giving our recording studio a sustainable makeover.
Just like music is made of notes and beats, each eco-friendly choice we make contributes a single note that completes the overall melody. That's why Heartbeat and U.S. Soy are teaming up to lead the discussion around greening Hollywood. We're talking slashing the carbon footprint of production with soy-based alternatives like soy-based inks for printing scripts, soy foam for soundproofing studios, and even biodiesel generators to power sets.
To see our podcast studio transformation, watch the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how we pulled the whole look together. It's all on @HeartbeatAudio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
So Mike, you go, you're doing your college circuit. I mean,
yeah.
you're getting spots in New York. You made the move.
Yeah.
This career now is starting to kind of blossom.
Yeah.
Right? It's starting to turn into something at this point.
Yeah.
When did the headlining side of comedy kick in?
So when I did New Faces, Montreal, you and I did New Faces probably really similar, 2001.
I was gonna see if you remember.
Are you 2001?
Yes.
Me
yes.
Too.
What are you talking about? We were in there.
Yeah.
We did together. I did
yeah.
I did New Faces, but I remember you being down there in Montreal. That was like my big thing that year.
That's huge. Yeah, so then I got to do Letterman from that. And that was, and you and I have the same agent, Mike Berkowitz.
Mike
booked us on the road, and Mike was coming up at that time at the same, you know, he's our age. And so he was coming up at the same time. So he didn't have a lot of clients. And I met with him. He watched my set at the Strip. And he goes, I think I could run with this because you're one of the youngest guys to do Letterman. So I'll just have that be the thing that, you know, one of the youngest guys to ever do Letterman. And, you know, put that was my credit when I would go to clubs. And man, in retrospect, Kev, I did not have a good hour. You know what I mean? Like they were charging for tickets. And then I wish I could pay back every last one of those people for thinking that was a headlining set. Like that was not good enough to fill an hour. So I'm going everywhere. Like I would go places. Like I remember going once to Springfield, Missouri. It was like a Funny Bone. There's like a pool table and like a ping pong thing in the back of the room, and it's loud and I'm fucking bombing. And the manager just calls the club, the owner of the chain, and just goes like, this guy just doesn't have it. And then they call off the rest of my night.
No.
Oh yeah. Like I used to have early on I had terrible sets, but you know what was actually a big break for me? It was like radio. So I was on Bob and Tom in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
Bob and Tom is a syndicated radio show. They're in like 100 plus little towns, mm-hmm. right? They're in Peoria and Bloomington and all these places all over the country. And so I did well on that radio show. And next thing you know, like I would go to Peoria or Colorado Springs or Tempe or whatever town. And I would do, you know, people would show up. Because they knew me from the radio. You know, radio is such an intimate form, as you know.
Did those lows ever affect you, though? Like, when you're talking about the things that happen at the comedy club. So you get there, and like you said, they were booking you as a headliner. You weren't ready. The reaction from the clubs and canceling the rest of your weekend or calling your agent and saying that this guy is X, Y, and Z. Did it weigh on you?
I think, honestly, when you're starting out, you're so delusional because you have to convince yourself it's going well. When it's really not going well, or else you'd never do it again, right? So I'm telling myself, like, I'm good, but I was not good. Like, I look back, I go, what was I doing? And honestly, like, the period of time where I really didn't have an hour and I was touring, it was like 6 months, you know? And so by the time I even had my head above water, I was going, oh, okay, I figured this out. And then the biggest pivot in my career was in 2008. I came up with the show Sleepwalk With Me, where I talked about my sleepwalking condition, where I literally jumped through a second story window of a motel in Washington State.
What?
Yeah.
Are you serious, Mike?
Yeah, it was actually at a NACA gig. So I was in Walla Walla, Washington at Whitman College.
Wow.
It was a string of colleges. It was like 6 colleges in 5 days. And I'm driving myself in a rental car all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been sleepwalking since like high school, college. I'd had like sleepwalking incidents, but never anything that was like shocking. And I had a dream that there was a guided missile headed towards my motel room, La Quinta Inn. And I jump out of bed and I say, what's the plan? They say the missile coordinates are set specifically on you. And I decide to jump out my window. So I was diagnosed with what was called REM behavior disorder, where people act out their dreams. And so I jumped through second story window. I ended up with stitches in my legs. I went to the emergency room and I built a whole show around it. And then I ended up making an independent film from it.
Holy fuck, man.
Yeah. It's a lot.
So wait a minute. So what's the disorder called again, Mike?
It's called REM sleep behavior disorder.
You knew that you had this condition. You knew that you that you had something.
I knew I had something. I knew I was sleepwalking. You know, like I'd have a dream, for example, that I was like, there was like a jackal hovering above my bed and I'd jump on the bed in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd wake up and my girlfriend would be like, there's a, you know, Michael, go to bed, you know, and I'll go, okay. And I'll go to bed, you know, that kind of thing.
So somebody would be with you and they could always get you out of it.
Exactly.
Okay. Got it.
Exactly. And so it was always this thing where it's like, huh, maybe I should see a doctor. But you know, when you're in your young 20s, you don't have fucking healthcare. You know, you don't really have a doctor. You don't, mm-hmm. you don't really have stuff figured out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, yeah, I should see a doctor. And then I thought like, maybe I'll eat dinner. And I went with dinner. You know what I mean? And so, you know what I mean? And so I never went to a doctor until I literally jumped through a second story window.
Jesus Christ, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
And after doing that, the doctor basically just let you know the condition and then told you the best way to handle it. How were you able to say like, okay, this is how I'm going to get a hold of it? Like, what was the key to getting a hold of it?
The key to getting a hold of it was twofold. One is I take medication, which is like an anti-anxiety before bed.
Okay.
And the second is, and people think I'm making this up and it's totally true, I sleep in a sleeping bag up to my neck. And for a while, I would wear mittens so I couldn't open the sleeping bag. I don't wear the mittens anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Was that suggested to you or did you come up with that?
No. That was my first sleep doctor. I've had like 3 or 4 sleep doctors since then, but that was my first sleep doctor.
This is so interesting to me.
Isn't that crazy, man?
No, it's mind blowing.
Yeah.
I've heard about, you know, the elevated side to sleepwalking conditions. You know, but I've never talked to anybody that's experienced it. You know, I've read things or, you know, in conversation of, oh my God, I heard that. Or have you ever seen like things like that? But I've never known that it existed at this level. This is insane.
Yeah, basically it's, you know, when you fall asleep, there's dopamine is released from your brain into your body that essentially paralyzes your body so you don't act out your dreams. Mm-hmm. And I have like what they call a dopamine deficiency. And so sometimes if I have an extreme dream, I'll act out the dream. But fortunately I'm diagnosed now, so I don't have it. I'll have it like once or twice a year. I'll have something, but I don't have it as much.
Is it not crazy that as comedians, we find ourselves in places where it's almost like the material writes itself?
Yeah, exactly.
Like you're sitting here talking to me about this, and then you go, you talked about it in your stand up. It's like surreal that as a comedian, you deal with this, and the one thing that you have that allows you to express yourself is the talent of bringing funny to anything that you choose to.
That's all.
So something that acts as a problem, you're now like making light of and making fun of.
That's what we got, you know. I mean, what's crazy, I was talking to Sarah Silverman the other day, who I loved it when she was on your show. I had her on my podcast, and I said to her, I go, like, you're one of the only people I can ask this of. I go, how come all of our comedian friends die?
Wow.
It's like, what the fuck, you know? Patrice is dead. Hedberg's dead, you know? Todd Lynn's dead. You know, like, all these people who are our friends, like, they seem like they're dying at a much higher rate than other people.
Mm-hmm. What I found from doing this podcast is we have to be funny because that's the career that we chose and that's what we've fallen in love with, right? And because we're so funny and our personalities portray fun and funny, some of us cover up the dark side, right? Yeah. Some of us cover up the part that's a problem. And I feel like you can only cover that up for so long. I feel like you can only cover up the problem for so long before the problem starts to leak out.
Yeah.
And if and when it leaks out, well, you know, it spills into your life in a way to where it can be detrimental. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it can be a lot. And I think as comedians, because it's a you versus you craft, you know, it's not sport, but it's a you versus you craft.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, the highs are high, but the lows are like solo lows.
Yeah.
And that's where the dark side of it comes from, man. And that's why I asked you, you know, when you were talking about you bombing and the rough patches in the beginning, did that weigh on you? Did it have an effect on you? And it was just good to hear you say, nah, like I had this weird level of confidence. I was fine. I was oblivious. Do you still feel like you, where do you operate at now from a confidence level in comedy?
From a confidence level, I'm in this place where it was refreshing when I heard you talk to Bill Burr and you're like, do you still love stand up? And I was like answering it in my head. I was like, oh yeah, I love stand up still. But it was nice to hear him be like, but I still want to get better. Cause that's how I feel. I'm like, none of us have cracked it. You know, we're all doing our best. We're all trying to make breakthroughs, but it's like, you know, when I think about like the next show I'm developing right now, it's called The Old Man in the Pool. And it's about hitting middle age and thinking about how, you know, you get, you know, they say the expression like over the hill. And I never understood the expression until I got on the hill and I looked around. I'm like, oh, there's natural causes. Like, they're not close, but they're coming. You know what I mean? But like, that's what the whole show is about. The whole show is about death. And I'm like, I want to do in this next show, I want people to laugh for an hour and a half about death so that we can all have a communion together about that. You know, because I think that's what comedy at its best is, when we're laughing at the things that we don't even want to think about, because that's like exercising it. You know what I mean?
I love that.
That's the catharsis. That's the catharsis.
No, I love that. I love that breakdown. And it's so true too. It's so true. I mean, for me, it's been the pain, you know, laughing at the pain.
Yeah.
That's why I think that was one of my best specials, because that's when I was going through like the most shit. And I found like the more shit that I go through, the funnier I have I have the opportunity to be funnier, right? I got a choice to make. It's like I can take the experiences and I can choose to talk about them in the only way that I know how, which is through stand up, or I can just swallow it and keep it to myself. And I found talking about the things like you just said, that you don't really want to, or the things that are like kind of problems or a little darker than most things, that's where you find the best humor at. That's where you find the best the best version of yourself in the craft, in my opinion.
Same.
What do you feel comedy is now? How do you like the state of comedy today?
I mean, I think it's great. I mean, I think like there's just too many comics. That's maybe like
it is.
That's like it's a like lot hard of to keep track.
It's a lot of
like, people are like, have you seen this person? I'm like, no, they're huge. You're like, all right, okay. Like, I can't keep up. And I feel like all I do is watch comedy and I still can't keep up. So that's great. I mean, that's good ultimately for the art form. There's more of a diversity of voices. There's way more women in comedy than there used to be. Like, there's so many things. But then also, because comedy is so popular, is like, that's why people get so mad about jokes. People get mad about jokes because those people never even used to hear jokes. Like, your comedy would never make it to them. And now comedy is like huge. It's like pop culture. And so it's this thing where people are like, well, I don't like that joke. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, not everybody's gonna like everybody's jokes. Like, it's crazy, because it's like, it didn't used to be like, you look at Pryor, for example, like all of us comedians were like, Pryor's the greatest. Or one, you know, certainly one of them, if not top three. You go, well, I wouldn't have agreed with Pryor. When I listen to his albums, I don't go like, oh yeah, he's right about everything. But I respect him, and I'm like, oh, that's a provocative observation.
You're spot on, but it's hard for everybody to look at it and be that simple with the look, right? You know, it's like, I feel like there's such a high level and want to be complicated or too complicated in today's time. And you know, another thing is just like, when you talk about comedy, you talk about how many comics there are. Well, you know, there's a void, where I guess you could say people are like, everybody wants to be funny. Like, people want to be funny, right? And the choice to be a comedian, to become a comedian, is because of the expectations of happy that are attached to it, right? I'm going to have fun. I'm going to have a good time. And I'm funny. Yeah. I make people laugh. Hence, I can make a career out of it.
Yeah.
It's the same way as kids right now that are gamers.
Yeah.
When you look at gamers right now, you know why the fucking gaming industry is growing?
Yeah.
Because kids love to play games. I can do what I love and I can get fucking paid for it. What's the same as comedy?
Yeah.
Right? It's the same thing. People love to fucking laugh and they love to people laugh. And if I can make people laugh and you're telling me that I can be good at it and get paid, oh my God, I'm going to try to give this a shot. That's why the numbers are growing. The numbers are growing because people are like, this is it, and I can now do this. And the internet has made it even, you know, even bigger because there's different roads that you can take into getting into comedy.
Yeah.
Into getting into the craft. The reason why I asked you just like, what do you think the state is? And I ask all comedians that come on here because it's just good to see where everybody's mind is today. It's good to see how people are thinking, right? Like some people are like, it's fucked up. It's fucked. And some people are like, no, it's cool. It's fine. You got to adjust. You got to make it sense. You know what I mean?
I think it's the upside is you got to look at people who have made it because of the internet. So you got like Bo Burnham. You got like Quinta Brunson. You got people who are like, that was their platform. Their platform was the internet. They actually weren't going to make it up through the club circuit because that wasn't available to them. So it's like, in that sense, the internet's great for comedy. And in another sense, it's kind of hell for comedy.
Yes. But that's with anything. It's a gift and a curse.
Yeah.
You're going to have the gift. You're going to have the curse. What do you want out of comedy? What's the goals for you, Mike?
This is a great question, Kev, because I think that's the existential question I'm trying to ask with my show, or one of them I should say is like, you hit middle age and you and I, you know, I have my daughter 6 and I don't know, your perspective changes. It's like when you have children or if you have children, often your perspective changes. I'm trying to be very general with my language so I don't tell people how they think and how they experience having children or not.
That's good though. That's what the times today have done.
Yeah.
They've made us all more conscious of how we say things.
Right.
Not what we say, but how.
That's right.
So, how we say it. So go ahead, take your time.
Yeah, my personal experience has been with having a daughter is it's not just what can I be, what kind of comedian can I be? It's like what can I do to be a decent role model, to be of service, you know, like even like in 2018 and 2020 with the elections, I didn't want to go in hard on like a candidate, but I did want to go in hard on like, I want people to vote.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out to colleges and performed like a free college event called Stand Up and Vote. And I would bring a bunch of comedians with me, like Jon Stewart did one of them and John Mulaney did one of them. It was just like, but like, there's things like that where I'm like, oh, when my daughter gets older, she can see that I'm doing that and understand that it's not just about me kind of, you know, spinning my wheels.
Yeah. I mean, you also can think of it like, for me, and I've talked about it a couple of times, it's just like, we're in a position now to make it all make sense at the end, right? And I just ask myself, what's the wrap up?
Oh, interesting. Wow.
What's the wrap up, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, every story, it has to have an end. And, you know, when I talked to Seinfeld, good friend, love him to death, respect him so much. My take on Seinfeld, I was like, you know, the bowing out of the TV show, it's like he did it before it could get bad.
Mm-hmm.
He did it before, like, you could say something bad or they could destroy it.
Yeah, yeah.
At the height of it, I chose to leave it, right?
Yeah.
And he has fun doing stand-up. He did another special, but, you know, it's not like it's this crazy consistent thing and putting him out.
Yeah.
And it just got me thinking, like, what's the wrap-up? Like, is there
is
there a bow-out for us as comedians where it's like you're in the best space?
Yeah, yeah.
You chose to stay there and move, or are we so engulfed into this thing that it's just never ending? Like, you know, you talk to Chappelle. Chappelle's like, it's never going to stop.
Yeah.
I'm never going to fucking stop. I'm doing it for fucking ever. You talk to Chris Rock. Chris is like, I don't give a fuck. I'm going to be doing it till I'm 70 because I just keep getting better and I keep getting funnier.
Yeah.
Right? And then
that's right.
I'm on the other side and I'm like, I just feel like there's got to be a wrap up.
Oh, really?
I feel like I'm... I don't know. I'm telling you, I struggle with this.
This is breaking news, Kev. This is breaking news.
I struggle with this, Mike.
There's got to be a wrap-up. Kevin Hart.
I'm just thinking, like, is there a wrap-up?
Yeah.
You know, whether it's 50 years old, 60 years old, is there a, I did it, I'm happy with what I was able to do and achieve?
I think you got to, whatever age you're at, for me, I'm turning 43 this month, and I think as a comedian, an artist of any kind, a creator of any kind, you need to be cognizant of what stage in life you're at and to be honest about what that stage is. So mm-hmm. I feel like the people who are lost are the guys who are 60 who are pretending to be 20.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But a guy who's 60 or woman who's 60 telling you what it's like to be 60, I'm into that. Like when I watch Chris Rock, when I watch Tambourine, I'm like, oh, I love this. I love this because this is where he's at.
It's truly the best.
Oh, I love it.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.
When's the last time you talked to an old person? Like a long conversation with an old person.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, just the other night with my parents. My parents are 80.
There's nothing more intriguing than a conversation with an old person.
Oh, yeah. It's fascinating.
It takes you getting older to value the conversation that an old person can give you.
Yeah.
Because it comes with so much experience, with so much knowledge and so much wisdom.
Oh yeah.
The information that you get from these conversations.
Yeah.
You can't purchase.
No, I had like one of the most connected conversations I've ever had with my dad the other night. And it's literally because I read this Malcolm Gladwell book called Bomber Mafia about World War II pilots. And he's read a million books about World War II and, you know, served in the military. So that was like one of the only things we have in common.
Wow.
Like my dad and I, like that we genuinely don't have that much in common. He's a doctor and I'm a comedian. And like, he always was like, oh, maybe this will parlay into advertising. Like he didn't think that it would be a thing. And now he's sort of like, oh, okay. You know,
are you guys close?
We're close in the sense that like everyone in my family, I'm youngest of four. So like,
okay.
We all do the holidays together, you know, we all have our own intimate relationships with each other, and me and my brother and sisters are really close. And I'm close with my parents, but like my stuff with my dad is hard. I talk about this in my book actually a bit, because like people who are 80, they either understand the internet or they don't. And in mm-hmm. his case, like he doesn't. So he'll get these email forwards with this crazy misinformation and he'll go, you know, what about this thing? And I'm like, that's not real. You know what I mean? Mm. Like you're sending me an email and it's like a conspiracy theory. So I don't know where we go from
here. Mm-hmm.
And so like, I think that's been hard for me to reconcile.
And what about your mom?
Very close with my mom. I mean, the one thing with my mom that's funny is, I've had all this shit with my, I'm in my office right now and we've had like tons of like leaks and like the roof has been fucked up and like there's like tons of stuff going wrong, but there's nothing like talking to an old person like your parents about how many leaks they have seen.
Oh my God.
In their lives.
Oh my God.
I mean, she was like, oh man. She goes, your whole childhood was leaks. Your whole childhood was like mildew and mold and all this shit.
That's what moms
and,
do.
Yeah.
Instant.
And so it gave me so much peace to talk to my mom about that stuff.
And how was your family? You say you got a big family. It's four of you guys.
Yeah, so my brother Joe like runs my production company, mm-hmm. so we're close. And my oldest sister Gina and second oldest sister Patty, and we're tight. I mean, I'm actually playing the Melody Tent in Cape Cod in August, and Patty's gonna fly across the country for it. Gina lives in Rhode Island. She's gonna be there. It's gonna be like a whole family thing. God knows what I'm going to say that's going to piss people off, but it should be fun.
When you first made the decision to do comedy, were they all supportive?
It breaks down party lines. My brother Joe was definitely, because he was always like part of the team. He and I would write jokes together. Pretty much same of Gina and Patty, my sisters. My mom was like not so into it. My dad was really against it. I mean, my dad was a doctor. And he got his law degree in his free time. So like when he sent me to college, like it wasn't so that I would become broke.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I get that. I actually get that more now than I did when I was 21 years old.
I mean, but seeing you benefit financially from comedy, from stand-up comedy, and it's parlayed into other things, writing, acting. Yeah. You know, has that kind of changed his outlook on it at all or still?
I think it has, sure. Yeah, I mean, like, we used to argue about that, and it's like now, like, we argue about current events. But, like, I agree with you. Like, I think connecting with the older people in our lives it's the thing that I have to remind myself to do because it's, you know, it's our relationship to the past, which is everything.
It's I'm telling you, man, it truly is one of the most refreshing things in the world. It's opened up my eyes to so much because talking to an old person, I give you one thing that an old guy said to me one time, right? One of my friends is 65. And when I talk to him, I'm always calling him an old bitch, you old bitch, right? And one day he said something so simple but so profound. He said, talk to me when you get here.
Oh, that's nice.
Talk to me when you get here.
Wow.
And that meant so many different things. That meant A, you'll be lucky to get to this age.
That's right.
And when you do get to this age, you'll be lucky to have somebody like you in your life that's talking and that you have a good time.
Yeah.
You'll be lucky to have somebody to give you what I'm giving you.
Yeah.
Basically was what he's saying. I broke it down on the way home and I gave it so many different meanings, but the appreciation for life grows as you get older.
Yeah.
Because you look back at all the shit that didn't have to go right, all the shit that went wrong that you're fine with and you're better because of.
Yeah.
There's so much of that. And I think for me now, Mike, it's one of those things where I'm like, what am I giving back?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I get what I was able to gain and get, but now that I have, what am I going to give back?
Yeah.
What am I putting back in to help the next generation?
Yep.
So that they come out better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I respect the fucking olders.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I call them that? Can I say olders?
The olders. Is that bad, the olders.
The olders.
The elders. The olders.
Elders is better, but I definitely said the olders. I told you I struggled.
Well, Keith, our mutual friend Keith Robinson is getting up there in age, right?
Keith Robinson just recovered. He had another stroke not too long ago.
Holy cow.
Recovered, man. I love that he just...
One of my favorite people I've ever met in my life.
I don't think there's anybody better.
I can't. And of course, I hope he doesn't hear this because he fucking relishes it. He knows it. He knows it and he soaks it up. He knows he's the funniest motherfucker. He knows he's the funniest guy. He knows he's salt of the earth. He's the greatest.
He is the best, man. He's truly the best. Let's talk about the business. Let's go to acting now, you know. What's the world of Mike like in the world of acting, writing, developing? Like, you know, what are you doing now?
I directed, in the last decade, I directed two independent films. The first one, Sleepwalk With Me, which has the story I was alluding to earlier. And the second one was called Don't Think Twice. It starred Keegan-Michael Key and Gillian Jacobs and me. And we're all part of this improv group where one of the people gets cast on like a Saturday Night Live type of show. Mm-hmm. And then everybody else doesn't. And it's about what happens with the bitterness.
I've seen it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I've seen this. Yeah. Wait a minute.
That's my baby. That movie's my baby.
Great. Yes. Yeah. This is great, man. It was so dope. It's like when one of them gets cast, like you get to see people like kind of break down.
Yeah.
It's honestly fucking comedy. It's like stand-up comedy as well.
So the craziest thing was Keegan hosted SNL a few weeks ago, you know, life imitating art. And so I went to the show with them and
Holy
it was like
cow.
You know, you got to hang out, and it was like the weirdest thing because we made this movie in 2016, and it was just such a weird, cool experience. It's like Honestly, nothing better. It was like one of the best nights of my life.
How are you with the directing bug? You know, after doing that,
is it
like a need to like, okay, I got to figure out the next thing, develop the next thing after that whole experience there?
Yeah.
Is it?
I love it. I love it. I actually wrote, well, you know, what's crazy is I wrote a pandemic script. My next movie was going to be a pandemic theme, like backdrop comedy, like thriller movie. And then the pandemic happened and I was like, fuck.
Are you fucking kidding me?
I swear to God. And so now I'm like, I'm just putting that on the back burner for a few years and I'm hoping we don't have fatigue. Cause honestly, I don't want to watch that movie right now. Like I try to make things that I want to watch. Right. And I feel like right now I just want to laugh. I just want to goof around. And so, but I do want to direct I want to direct more movies. Whenever I act in stuff, I've acted on Billions or Orange is the New Black or Trainwreck or whatever it is. I'm just trying to learn from the director. I want to learn from Judd Apatow. I want to learn, you know, from Genji, Orange is the New Black, or whoever it is. Cause I, you know, ultimately I think my gift is to create things. And so like, you know, when I talk to you, I'm always thinking, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, I hope I can direct you in a movie someday. Cause I love your acting. I think you're one of the best actors. So I hope we can do something someday.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. Mike, stop it, man. Make me blush on here. It's a podcast. People see that side of me. I love your approach to comedy. I love your take on funny. I've been a fan. And what I really like about this, man, is that it's exactly what it's supposed to be. You know, in doing this podcast, I'm supposed to walk away with a different understanding of the person I'm talking to, right? And you know, the conversation is enforced. It's great dialogue. Great fucking dialogue. And learning about you, learning about just the things that you've been through, the things you've opened up about, that's what the fuck this is about. And that's what I feel like as comedians, what we're able to do, we're able to be comfortable in our discomfort. Think about that. Think about that, listeners. We're able to be comfortable in our discomfort. And that's what makes us special. That's what makes us unique.
And that's an everyday struggle too, by the way. I mean, that never ends.
Absolutely.
The ability to try to find comfort and discomfort, that's every fucking day.
And those that figure it out, 9 times out of 10 have a high level of success with themselves. It's literally about mastering yourself. And, you know, Mike, hey, I'm happy that you've gotten a hold on the sleepwalking and what that was. I'm glad you finally went to the doctor, because thank God that the window incident wasn't more than what it was, right? And that you're here to talk about it. I'm excited for your next special. I'm excited to see what this hour and a half about death or about the look into death can shape up and become.
Yeah.
When do you think you're gonna be going out?
I'm going out in the fall. Doing like the Chicago theater. I'm doing like the Miriam, Philadelphia, your hometown, and like a lot of places that I'd love to tour to. And then I'm hopefully gonna, I brought the last show to Broadway. We did the new one for 100 performances on Broadway. And I'm hoping The Old Man in the Pool follows that model.
I love it. And that's another thing, man, you're creating your own lane and your own space. Like, you know, going to Broadway, taking your show, these one man shows and doing it different. Like, dude, you're in a space of your own, and deservingly so, man. I'm a fan, I'm forever a friend. And I just gotta say thank you. Thank you for coming on to talk to me, man. I'm glad you fucking hit me. Like that's how simple this is. Like when you hit me, I was like, hell yeah, Mike. Fuck yeah, I want to talk to you. Like it's that easy. But more importantly, it's a need. It's a must for more of this, dude. So let's not be that big of strangers. Moving forward, man. I want to know that you're okay. I want to update on what's going on. You fucking hit me, dude. All right.
Yeah, I will.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Comedy Gold Mines, and oh my God, what amazing minds they are. Today's mind was no different. Mike Birbiglia. Holy shit. Guess what? We got to learn a little more about him. And I'm glad we did. Mike, thanks again, dude. I appreciate
it. Kev, this is the best. I love you.
All right, man. Love you back. Be safe. To our listeners, I can't wait till next time. Peace.
Comedy Gold Mines is a Sirius XM and LOL audio production. Executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, and Eric Weil. With Tastemakers Media, Emil Garner, and Ian McDonald.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.
NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. If approved, applications are typically funded the next business day or sooner. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit. Credit to the people.